Welcome. This is the podcast of Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
Welcome to our Care in Action podcast. Today we are doing an online podcast, and the reason for that is that I have a very special guest who lives in New York, and I'm talking about Richard Stengel. A very warm welcome to the podcast of Care Austria, Richard.
Thank you. I'm so pleased to be with you.
And as normally, I also will introduce our guest of today briefly before we dive into our conversation. Richard Stengel is a distinguished journalist, author, and co-chair of the Board of Directors for Care USA. There he has served since 2017. He also appears as a political analyst, offering expert commentary on political and international affairs. Richard's notable career includes his role as Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs and Managing Editor of Times magazine. He is the author of several influential books, including Nelson Mandela's Long Walk to Freedom and Information Wars. Before we start talking a little bit about the books, Richard, I want to turn immediately to your role as co-chair of the CARE US Board of Directors. And our appreciated listeners, they know that the mission of CARE worldwide, globally, is fighting poverty with a very strong focus on women and girls. So what attracted you to CARE?
Yes, it's a good question. And you mentioned in my bio that I had been Undersecretary of State under the Obama administration. And when I was leaving government in 2016, I wanted to be able to do something that I felt proud of, that represented the values that I thought I had represented when I was at the State Department. And I knew Michelle Nunn, who was the CEO of CARE. We had previously collaborated before she was at CARE with a national service movement that I also had helped lead when I was at Time. And it seemed like a wonderful fit. I'm very proud of the mission. I'm very proud of the fact that it touches base with American generosity, the buildup after World War II of many American-led institutions, notably the Marshall Fund, which was really something new and extraordinary, but other institutions that have stood the test of time, the World Bank, the IMF, and CARE was part of that group of new endeavors. It's kind of a sibling. And it started with sending relief to people in Europe, in France originally. And of course, it, as you know, has broadened out. We're in 111 countries now. We're a mixture of humanitarian and development programs, and with a focus on women and girls, which I think is incredibly important. And I'm just very, very proud of the work that we do.
And as a matter of fact, Austria and its citizens in the aftermath of World War II were some of the biggest benefiters of the movement of sending care packages. I don't know if you have heard that, Richard, but in Austria, every seventh person at that time received a care package. And I had many interesting conversations also in this podcast series with Time testimonials, and they all tell me that this created a super positive attitude and picture towards the United States, starting 80 years ago. And my generation was brought up with this positive attitude towards the US. And it's still there somehow, because original care packages, they are still kept by people on top of their kitchen. And they were, this experience was so moving, because they said two aspects were life-saving. One was the content of the package that people needed, because Vienna was hungry at that time. People were starving. And the second aspect that was as relevant, they told me, is that somebody that far away was thinking about them and sending them something for their own good. And this is very, very much present still in Austria.
Yes, it's so powerful the way you said it. And I hope you've kept all those records of those conversations. Good. I would sometime love to read some of them, see some of them. It's very powerful testimony. And, you know, it's something which was important in those days, 80 years ago. It's still very important now. And I'm not just talking about the sort of the reputation of the U.S., which obviously is undergoing some changes at the moment, but this idea that people in one part of the world care about people in another part of the world and are willing to be generous in order to help them, assist them. Even all of that is changing as well, because we have so many programs around the world that are about social purpose. The Village Savings and Loan Program, which helps women around the world take out loans for small businesses and things like that. So it has changed, but the mission is the same, and the sentiment behind the care package is still the same.
Before we move on to the challenges of doing global humanitarian work today, I want to share with you only one aspect that didn't leave my brain since last week when we did this video production. One of the ladies, she was 7 years when she received, her family received the first care package. They received various ones, and she is now far over 85. Imagine, she came to our office, did a professional video production, and she said, "When I was a child already, I was really puzzled because I always asked my parents, whom can we say thank you for the care package?" Mm. And then he used the opportunity of the video production to thank Care US, all of us, on behalf of her. He said, "I want to say thank you now to Care and the people who are Care today for the care packages that I have received 18 years ago." Can you imagine that?
Yeah, very moving. And I hope we can continue to do that.
So do I. And let's talk one moment about, because we are facing some pressing challenges, trying and delivering humanitarian aid globally. From where you sit on the board of directors of Care USA, what, from your point of view, is the most pressing one, the most pressing challenges?
Well, we're suffering from what someone called the three C's, conflict, COVID, and climate change. And they're changing the world, you know, not for the better. And there is conflict in so many places in the world that it interrupts our ability to help people. Obviously, notably right now in Gaza, right now in Ukraine. Climate change is changing the habits of people and making it more difficult for agriculture to work, for the right kind of food to get to people. And all of this has also resulted in the greatest displacement of people since World War II. The number of refugees in the world is the highest since those days. So all of those are gigantic challenges. And I think there's also the challenge now of the more conservative shift in so many governments in Europe, the election in the U.S. now, with a new president who has never been a supporter of any kind of foreign aid. And those will be new challenges for us, because the humanitarian challenge is only getting bigger. So we need to try to meet that. And I think the circumstances in which we meet that have become more difficult.
Yes, I fully agree. And we have talked already quite a lot about the global humanity and how important it is to connect continents and people also thinking in a sort of solidarity of each other. So let's move on to one of the biggest humanitarians of last century or this century, I would say. Let's talk a little bit about Nelson Mandela. You had the honor and I would say also the privilege to write his biography, Long Walk to Freedom, very famous and very well known. For those who are not so familiar with Nelson Mandela, I think everyone has heard of him, but he lived from 1918 to December 2013. He was the first elected president of South Africa, and I think we can call him a global icon of humanity and justice, fighting lifelong against apartheid. He spent more than 27 years in prison, and we are now able to have a chat with a person who really knew him quite well, because it took quite the time to write the biography, right? It was in the 90s, am I right?
Yeah, so I worked with him on his autobiography, and that was about a 3 or 4 year project. I wrote a book about that myself called Mandela's Way. And then you can also, amazingly enough, listen to a podcast / audiobook of our conversations together called Mandela, The Lost Tapes, which I think is in 10 parts. Really, it's astonishing to hear his voice again in that intimate setting. And he was, as you say, I mean, he had become a global icon. He is truly, truly great man. A giant figure, but a giant also in terms not only of what he achieved, but in moral purpose and his great goal, because his great goal was bringing freedom and democracy to his people. People forget how, and maybe younger people don't even know, there was this system of white supremacy and racial separation in South Africa called apartheid, which was an Afrikaans word meaning separateness. And it was a continuation of the British colonial system. And extraordinarily enough, that it only came into power, speaking of World War II, in 1948. People think it's much older than that. The national government was elected in 1948 and created this statutory system of separation and discrimination against the black majority in South Africa. Whites were only about 10% of the population. And so he grew up in that environment. And so at a time when most of the world was moving towards democracy after World War II and moving away from colonialization, South Africa was moving in the opposite direction. And his great mission was to change that, was to bring freedom to his people, one person, one vote election. And he suffered for it greatly. I mean, he was in prison, as you mentioned, for 27 years, never gave up hope, never stopped thinking about what he would do when he came out. And in fact, when he came out, I mean, it was kind of amazing how absolutely prepared he was. He was 71 years old, and he had a plan, and he executed on it, you know, with great courage, and eventually triumphed.
No, but this is all super impressive and really interesting. And I can imagine that when you have that much and that close contact with such an interesting person, there are some learnings, right? Some experiences that really shaped a little bit your own personality. Or is that too much?
Yes. So when I was working with him on his book, of course, I had to think and try to think like Nelson Mandela, which is a very useful ritual. And I think I probably was a better person in those days when I was working on it, because I was thinking all the time, what would Nelson Mandela do? What would Nelson Mandela say? And I still try to do that. I don't do it as much. But the things that I learned from him were from his incredible self-discipline, his extraordinary filter, where he, you know, I mean, people have done terrible things to him, and he never had an unkind word to say about almost anybody. There's a couple of small exceptions. His generosity with the people who had imprisoned him, who had destroyed his family. People always say it's extraordinary that he had no bitterness, and I laugh at that because, of course, he was bitter. But his strength and his genius as a leader came from the fact that he knew he had to hide his bitterness. He couldn't let anybody see it. He had to make sure people saw him as a reconciler, as someone who would accept his own enemies at the same table, which he did do, which was really evidence of his leadership and his discipline.
Did he also have his weak moments that he shared with you, or did he never lose sight of his aim in life?
He was a human being, as he was the first to tell you. He had made many mistakes as a young man before he went to prison. I actually remember one time where when we were working together, and out of the blue, he asked me, where were the countries in the world where people could vote who are younger than the age of 18? So I did some research and I gave him a list. I wasn't sure why he was proposing that. And I think the youngest country with the youngest voters was Libya, which is not exactly a democracy. And then a couple of days later at a press conference, he announced that he wanted to, make South Africa's voting age 14. Well,
wow.
nobody knew where this came from. People were actually kind of horrified. I didn't tell anybody about our conversation. So I guess that's it, you know, and it never happened. And that, turned out to have been a mistake. And part of it was just, you know, South Africa then and still now as an incredibly youthful society. And the lower you make the voting age, the more voters there are. It's like, it's the bottom end of the pyramid. So, and anyway, that's a small example of a mistake that's not a very big mistake. And he eventually, you know, he eventually apologized for it and said it was a mistake, which is another sign of leadership too.
To be able to say this might have been a mistake.
Yes. Yes. We don't see that enough these days.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, CARE is currently working in many sub-Saharan African countries where populations are super young. You also see that in South Asia. So the initial thought of allowing very young people to participate is somehow understandable looking at the demography pyramids of some of the countries that we are working in. And Richard, we move on. Of course, we will not get too political because our listeners know that CARE is the biggest partner in Europe of the European Union, one of the biggest partners in the United States. CARE US is partnering with USAID. So CARE is working with institutional funding and helping through institutional funding millions of people globally. But you wrote a few years ago a very interesting book, which is more relevant than ever, I would say. I have it here at my side, Information Wars. And the subtitle is How We Lost the Global Battle Against Disinformation. And it already suggests that before the phenomena that we are seeing now after elections in many European countries and in the US, that somehow maybe we already lost the battle. Would you say we lost the battle against disinformation from your current point of view? Would you say that now?
I wouldn't say that. Book titles are commercial instruments, and I think everyone thought that was a more interesting and provocative title. Part of what I've learned about mis and disinformation is that it's always been around. Disinformation is as old as information. And we've seen that throughout history. The difference is the ease of access. I don't even know if it's a larger percentage of all the information available because there's more information available now, factual information than any time in human history by an exponential margin. But the disinformation and misinformation seeks you out. We seek it out. And therefore, it gives the sense that it's more present even than it is, and more influential even than it is. So I think it's a constant battle. It's been a constant battle through human history. And, you know, the irony, of course, is that there are more ways to check information and check conspiracy theories on your phone, in your hand, than any time in human history. And yet people don't seem to be doing that. So some of that is, as I wrote in Information Wars, we don't have a fake news problem. We have a media literacy problem. People don't know and aren't taught how to actually find out what the fact is and how to refute a falsehood. And all of those things need to become part of the way we train and teach kids in school, just the way they should be learning how to program a computer and use a computer. They need to learn about media literacy. And one of the things that surprised me, and I wrote about in the book, and after the Trump's first election in 2016, is just also how little people really knew about how journalism worked. And people seemed surprised when you told them, we have fact checkers for every story. We have libel lawyers who look at every story. We have three different people who edit the story. It's like, wow. I mean, there are very few things, I mean, other than, you know, in medicine, I suppose, or engineering in our culture that are vetted as much as just a single story in a reputable journalistic organ. So I think we have to teach people about that. And one of the things that I recommend in the book is a kind of radical transparency that journalists need to have. Like, let people see your sources. Let people see the text of your interview. Let people see your notes. Let people see what goes into a story, and then they won't dismiss it so cavalierly.
Is this something that we have missed out maybe in the last years? Maybe we were too self-convinced, too much focused on, because you use the word mainstream media a lot, and this is also something that is highly debated in the European context. Established media is not consumed to the same extent than it was 20, 30 years ago. And there is a common, never generalized, but we can see a common mistrust of some parts of our societies, not only in the US, also here in many European countries, towards established so-called mainstream media. And you even mentioned it, that nowadays we have, and we are doing a podcast too. This is not, Care Austria is not the Austrian broadcasting station. And we have many more tools than we had 10 years ago to really communicate our opinions plus facts. But what I see personally, that many people and also some media people are not so clear whether it's their opinion or it's a fact, what they are communicating.
Yes.
And that adds to the complexity a bit. What is your take on that?
Yes, that's a very good point. And I also talk a little bit about that in the book, and the movement of in mainstream journalism away from purely fact-based journalism to more opinion-based journalism. And people have said that they don't like that. I actually think in many ways it's a renaissance in the media world, because there are things like podcasts, which is a very ancient form. We're talking to each other in a long form context. I mean, that's a great way to deliver information. It's a great way to establish trust. All of these things are fantastic means of communication and fantastic new forms of journalism. And so I really don't bemoan the fact that there are these new things, or even that people are less reliant on mainstream media. In fact, I also have argued that people were too trusting of mainstream media 30, 40 years ago than they should have been. You know, they were much more victims of propaganda then in some ways than they are now. And I think a certain amount of skepticism is healthy, healthy on the part of the listener or the reader, and healthy on the part of the journalist. So I'm optimistic that these new forms of communication can be useful. I mean, just because a TikTok is, you know, 20 seconds long doesn't mean it should be false. You can tell the truth in 20 seconds, just like you can tell a lie in 20 seconds. There's nothing about the medium that is intrinsically tends toward falsehood versus fact. So I just think we have to use the new tools.
And I think we have to develop new cultural techniques that allow us to educate ourselves, our children, the next generation, to really be able to deal with all the tools that are available today. And from a standpoint of Care Austria, we started 3 years ago already this podcast series to allow our donors, also institutional donors, well-known personalities, more insight in care. Because we are very transparent. You can hear so many interesting things about our humanitarian work that you will not find in any written form simply because the place is not there. And we are also very transparent about the network of Care Austria and Care. And this is really, really a big and interesting one. Of course, we are all not free from this, what you call and others call the confirmation bias, right? Because we are in our own information bubbles or echo chambers, and we should leave them, all of us, more often. But this is, of course, something that is not supported by social media or your choice of podcasts, etc.
Right? Yes. So, yes, you have a few things in your question, Andrea, but I want to also talk about the fact that Care Austria is a vital part of the care network and has, for as long as you've been there, and I'm sure before, punched above its weight in terms of its contribution around the world and to the care network. Also in terms of your own marketing and branding and media, you're also almost singular compared with all of the different care branches. I shouldn't play favorites, but I wish everybody was as smart about it as you are, because we have to tell people what we do in order to be able to do what we do. And that's just a fact of life. And we all need to get better at that. So, yes, I mean, I talk a little bit about this great, great American social scientist. He's actually an economist named Daniel Kahneman. He won the Nobel Prize in economics. And he is really, in many ways, the author with his partner of this idea of cognitive biases, the most famous of which is confirmation bias, which is that we seek out information that we already agree with. And then we see it, and then we feel like it confirms what we already think, and we feel better, and we don't question it. So part of why there is a disinformation crisis is that we seek it out ourselves. It's not inflicted on us. It's a buyer's market. It's not a seller's market. And so, I quote that old song, the refrain of it is lie to me and I promise to believe. That's how we all are as human beings. So, I mean, part of fighting disinformation is fighting human nature, which is one reason it's so hard.
So let's be all a bit more brave and leave sometimes our own echo chamber, which is not only inspiring, it's also interesting, and it leads the way forward, I think, because divide never is a good idea and never is a good approach, be it in institutions or be it in countries or society. I think we have to come to an end with divide. And unfortunately, also we will come to an end. But before we close, I mean, I don't want to flatter you. Your career is really interesting from a European perspective. I remember well when I was a student, alone buying the Time magazine every week in Vienna in that time, and I'm not that old, was a challenge. It was only available in selected stalls. You had to go to the main train station. There you could find international magazines. Then I ordered it to get it on a regular basis. And for us, it is really a big honor to have the opportunity to talk to the former chief editor of Time magazine, or should I put it more correctly, for me, it is a big honor. So, Richard, I'm sure you have those key moments in your career that really influenced your worldview. Is there one that you can share with us, or two?
Well, you mentioned I spent many years at Time as a writer and editor before I became the editor. And, you know, one of the things I see happening now, and I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing, is that, you know, and I'm older than you, so I'll say in my era, you often, and we didn't use this word, but you apprenticed yourself to someone or some organization to learn what, to get good at the thing you wanted to do. I mean, Malcolm Gladwell has this thesis that you need 10,000 hours of doing something to establish mastery of it. And so I spent a lot of years toiling in the vineyards, you know, learning to write and report and fact check before it became something that I thought I was good at. And I think now, because of people don't stay in jobs for a very long time, they move around a lot, getting that kind of expertise is probably going to be a little more difficult. Plus, with things like AI and eventually generative AI, you know, that a lot of those things will be done for us. And so I sometimes fear that while machines and technology are getting smarter, we're getting dumber. And there's a relationship between the two. So, you know, it's Plato who said, never write anything down because then you'll forget it. You know, that was a long time ago. So, there's so many things that had an influence on my life, and people always think that, oh, you had all of these things in mind, when you started. And so much of it is serendipity. And I have two sons, and I would tell them, you know, there is such a thing as luck, and it's a combination of preparation and then grasping at the opportunity. You make your own luck. And so,
the opportunity as a good and option, right?
Yes. And so, so you have to be prepared to be lucky. And I always felt that way. By the way, you mentioned flattery. I wrote a whole book about flattery many years in like 1980s. So you can't flatter me because I know how it works. but of course, the reason flattery works is the same reason disinformation works, is because we love it and accept it. It's like, we welcome it. So, and there was a funny social science study where in those days it showed that people of high self-esteem are more susceptible to flattery than people of low self-esteem, because people with low self-esteem say, well, that's not true. I'm not a great person, even though that person told me I'm a great person. But people of high self-esteem say, yes, she's right. She's telling me what a great person I am. So there's lots of funny things about that too. But anyway, we're going off topic now.
And it adds to histories of big brands, and Time magazine for sure is a big brand until today. And this is also a bit part of the whole magic, isn't it? And it should work for Care the same way, because Care has a super brand history and really
yes.
Interesting people aligned with the brand of Care. Interesting, smart people globally who are working with all their heart, all their knowledge and all their experiences. And this should add also to our global brand history, which is more needed than ever, I would say. Let's close with something that is a big issue around the globe and also inside Care somehow. We need humanitarian leaders. We need leaders that are efficient, smart, and really human. So how can we shape these leaders also inside CARE? And you as the co-chair of the board of directors of CARE US?
Well, that's a big question. And I think we're looking at an empathy deficit among leaders, political leaders around the world today, where people are thinking less. They're more nationalistic. They're thinking less about the rest of the world and more about their own country. Nationalism is often the enemy of philanthropy and helping people, and also the enemy of another term, which I'll use an example of Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela said many years ago that alleviating poverty is not an act of charity, it's an act of justice. And so we need more leaders campaigning for that kind of social justice around the world. And I think there's a deficit of them in the political space. That's why, to your point, we need more humanitarian leaders who combine empathy and look at that as a virtue and as a strength, not as a weakness, the way authoritarian leaders look at empathy as a weakness, not a strength. So I think we have some great leaders across the CARE network. I put you in that category. Michelle Nunn, who's the CEO of CARE US, is a powerful leader. But I think, you know, we can't be softies, and we have to be hard-headed about doing the positive things that we know need to be done and figuring out how to do them, particularly in a climate that is less hospitable to it than before.
So I do suggest, Richard, that CARE US and CARE Austria and all other CARE members around the globe, we start building more of these bridges, like the bridge that the two of us built this morning in New York and this late afternoon here in Vienna. I'm really thankful that you took your time to have this conversation. I really want to shout out to our listeners to also check out the podcast that I did a few months ago with my colleague Michelle Nunn. Richard mentioned her at various times. And I do invite all of our listeners, please join forces with CARE. We are a global force, a global confederation, and we are able to fight poverty, but only if many, many people around the globe help us in doing that. Richard Stengel, it was a big honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And thank you for what you do. And thank you for what CARE Austria does.
Thanks for listening. This was CARE in Action, the podcast of CARE Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For further information, go to care.at. Sponsored by CC Real.